You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During the 6+ years of George W. Bush's presidency, 57 species have been declared endangered, in most cases as the result of a lawsuit. That's fewer than under any president since the Endangered Species Act was signed by Richard Nixon in 1973. Now, Bush administration officials are reviewing proposed changes to the way the act is enforced, and on today's Underreported, we will look at how that could affect the survival of endangered species. Joining me now is Stuart Pim, a conservation biologist and professor of conservation ecology at Duke University. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Have the changes been released to the public yet?
I don't believe they have, although this is a situation that's, sort of changing by the minute, so I can't guarantee they didn't come out this morning. So we really don't have a very good idea what they are, although the rumor is that they contain elements of changes that were put forward by a bill introduced to the House by Representative Pombo about 15 months ago.
Would they change the law or the way it's enforced?
Well, the Pombo bill, which failed disappeared as we got a new Congress, would have changed the law. From what I understand, this is a matter of applying, sort of different guidelines and different rules, and that would be, those would be administrative ones that would be operated by Secretary of Interior Kemp Thorne.
Now, Representative Pombo is a rancher, as I understand it, in California, so would his bill have given landowners more rights and the endangered species fewer rights?
I think that's probably too kind a way to put it. I think what former Representative Pombo was trying to do was to very seriously gut the act. I don't think anybody disagrees that we need to look at ways in which to reward landowners who have been good stewards of their environment. If they haven't been good stewards, they wouldn't have endangered species on their land. So I think everybody understands that it's important to come to terms with that. But I'm afraid I was not impressed by the way that former Representative Pombo went about that.
Well, is this Congress likely to support a bill that would gut the Endangered Species Act?
Well, we have a very different Congress now than we did 15 months ago. And there is some very strong leadership in Congress on environmental issues now, which for those of us who are concerned about the environment is very much of a refreshing change.
What are some of the problems with the way the endangered species laws are being enforced these days? Is a change in the way they are being enforced the reason that we have fewer cases now than we have under any other president since Richard Nixon?
Yes. But, before one talks about gloom and doom, the act has been spectacularly successful. For many years, I was a professor at Columbia, one of the treats was to see the peregrine falcons flying around my office on the Upper West Side. You go to Jamaica Bay, you look at the spectacular wildlife there. There's an awful lot of good things that have happened because of the Endangered Species Act.
So New York is one of the success stories?
New York is definitely one of the success stories. The peregrine falcon is a bird that essentially disappeared from eastern North America. It was brought back. A strong Endangered Species Act protected it. I remember one morning going to work and having a Jurassic Park moment when a pigeon wing sort of wafted down from where a peregrine had plucked it. There's a lot of good things that have happened. I mean, even in New York City, which many people think is an unlikely place to study wildlife, you can see a lot of spectacular wildlife, and the Endangered Species Act has helped make that possible. But to be successful, a species has to be, as we say, technically listed. It has to be put on the list. And so what is very concerning is that the current administration has listed fewer species than any administration before it.
Well, can't we say that's because the act has been a success over the years and there are fewer endangered species?
I wish that were true. I don't think it's the case. And what puts this in particularly strong perspective is that a large fraction, I don't know exactly offhand, but a large fraction of those listings came about because other organizations filed suit you know, to get the Fish and Wildlife Service to act. So it's not something they've done willingly. It's they've done something in response to you know, lawsuits that have gone against them.
I'm speaking with Stuart Pym, a conservation biologist, professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, as part of our underreported series. Well, let's back up a bit. You said that many of the cases, the 57 cases during this administration, were the result of lawsuits. How is it usually done? How is it determined that a species is endangered in the first place?
Well, it could range from a group of professional biologists, and often the people in the Fish and Wildlife Service themselves, to sometimes, you know, very competent groups of amateur naturalists, you know, who would say, look, we believe there is a case to be made for putting species X on the list. They would write to the Fish and Wildlife Service. The arguments for and against would be listed in the Federal Register. There would be a comment period, and then the Fish and Wildlife Service would make a determination that the species should be listed.
Are there different levels of endangerment? Vulnerable, endangered, but
yes,
stable, endangered, and critical?
There are various schemes. But within the Endangered Species Act, there are two. There's endangered and threatened, threatened being less of a problem than endangered. Internationally, we have what's called the Red List, and that has different a series of different things, from critical to vulnerable to threatened to near threatened. But within our country's laws, there are just two: threatened and endangered.
And you say there's an international agreement as well, because in some cases, birds, for example, that birds that migrate or butterflies that migrate, there isn't just one place that they might be endangered in.
Absolutely not. Many of many of the species. I mean, in a few months' time, people will be watching their baseball games, and flying around the baseball stadium in the evening are going to be nighthawks. You know, those nighthawks are presently somewhere in Central and South America, and they fly up and scarf up our insects in the summertime, and then fly south when the pickings get slim.
Under the current law, how long does the process take? Do species ever become extinct while they're waiting to be declared endangered?
Yes. I think the important thing, the big statistic, is once the species is on the list, its chances of survival are very, very good indeed. Species generally don't go extinct when we put them on the list. The Act is spectacularly successful at preventing extinction. The problem is that if you're not put on the list, it's sort of rather not like not getting medical care, you know. You're going to be in deep trouble. And the species that have not been put on the list that people think should have been, those are the species that have tended to go extinct in the last 6 years or so.
How many of the species put on the endangered list recovered enough so that they could be removed from the list?
Not many. And partly due to the fact is, you know, it's sort of like going to hospital and because you're sick and complaining that, you know, an hour later you're not feeling better. It does take time. The examples of the peregrine have taken 25 years. On the West Coast, gray whales were almost on the point of extinction. They were protected. They've grown slowly but consistently year after year after year to when they become a major tourist spectacle. It takes a while for things to recover. They don't recover sort of instantly. And so things that were put on early, many of them have recovered. Sadly, sometimes species are put on very much at the last minute and they don't have a chance. But overall, lots of examples of species that have come back.
Who makes the ultimate decision? Are there certain criteria that must be met other than I say that this species is endangered and I'd like to have something changed?
As I say, it's a very thorough process whereby a species is put on the list. The most recent cases involve the polar bear, which most scientists believe is being threatened by melting sea ice, which is a consequence of global warming, melting the Arctic Ocean.
So that makes it a political issue as well as an endangerment issue.
you bet it makes it a political issue. But in that particular case, there are, you know, I think there was something like 30 pages of information that the Fish and Wildlife Service put on its website, in the, you know, the listing website. And then there's a long period where people can write in and support that or contradict it. It's a very open, transparent process. It works like science is supposed to do, which is to, you know, get all the facts out there and have a good debate about what they all mean.
But can it get rather complicated at times? For example, the much publicized spotted owl in the Pacific Northwest, which was considered threatened because its habitat was reduced by logging, and now the spotted owl seemed to be under attack by the barred owl. So there are people out there who want to kill as many of the barred owls as they can so that the spotted owls will have a chance of thriving.
Well, you know, I was listening on the news item just before the show started and talking about longhorn beetles causing damage in the city. Introduced species that come in from elsewhere can do a huge amount of harm economically, biologically. In the case of the barred owls, as we've changed the nature of the landscape, barred owls, which basically belong in the east, and spotted owls that belong in the west, are beginning to come together, and the barred owls have the upper hand. So, yes, issues like that can make life very complicated.
Because they affect the ecosystem? What would happen if we just allowed things to progress the way they might, let nature take its course? Is the world worse off now without the passenger pigeon? Would we be worse off without the bald eagle?
You know, the line I like is from, lions and tigers and bears, oh my. You know, who would want to be watching The Wizard of Oz with their kids or their grandkids and to have them turn around and say, you know, Granddad, what are lions and tigers and bears? You know, and Granddad turns around and says, well, they're species that we let go extinct. Species are going extinct about 1,000 times faster than they should be because of our human actions. And to me, that's an ethical issue. It's personally, it's a religious issue for me, but it's also a matter of what sort of world do we hand to our children and our grandchildren. And if we leave that world impoverished, one can only imagine what they would think of us.
Well, we're talking about changes in the Endangered Species Act, proposed changes, and you are opposed to them. But do you think that the act is perfect? If you could change it, what would you do?
No, I don't think the act is perfect, but I think it's been hugely successful, and I wouldn't want it to be gutted in the hope that we would get something a lot better. Clearly, the process whereby species get put on the list needs to be applied more consistently, and hugely importantly, the matter of how the act relates to private landowners. There's no question that a key issue is what can we do to reward private landowners who've been good stewards of their land. Many of the, you know, people who've gone in and chopped all their forests down or otherwise modified their land don't have endangered species on them. If they do have endangered species on them, the Fish and Wildlife Service is trying to tell them what to do with their land. And clearly we need some ways of rewarding people and working with the people who have been good stewards of their land. There are organizations who are doing that, and I'm very encouraged by the kind of processes that they can work out. As I said, it's the people who've got those species are the people generally who care most about their property.
My guest is Professor Stuart Pym of Duke University. He's a conservation biologist, and we're talking about proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act. Well, if Congress is not going to pass a new law, they're not going to pass a version of the Pombo Act, then how would these proposed changes be put into effect?
Well, as I said, I haven't seen them in any great detail. People have seen the leaked report. I think in all fairness to Secretary Kempthorne, it would be prudent for us to wait and see what he decides before we attack him. I have talked to I may have called him Senator Kemp Thorne. He was a senator when I first testified in front of these committees. I've always found him a person who is very amenable to discussions about this. I know it's something he cares very much about personally. So I think we should give him, you know, give him time to come out with the proposals, and then we should take a look at them. It would be really wrong for me to speculate about draft proposals, because I don't think anybody's had a good chance to look at them yet.
That wasn't my question. My question was, if Congress is not willing to pass a law like this, can this just be put into effect by executive order?
It's a matter of not knowing exactly what's being proposed. I think there's clearly some things that can, and clearly the fact that under the previous Secretary of Interior, almost nothing was listed without a lawsuit. That was clearly an executive branch decision. It wasn't something that typified the service so much as what it was being instructed to do. So, yes, there's no doubt that the Secretary can make a lot of decisions.
You mentioned climate change as a problem. If predictions about climate change are true, do you think that the extinction rate will rise no matter what kind of law is in effect?
Yes, I mean, there's no question that as climate change continues, as things begin to warm up, it's going to put a huge burden on top of endangered species that are already endangered, and it's going to create new ones. The very fact that we're seeing endangered species in remote parts of the Arctic, of Greenland, of the Canadian Arctic, of islands north of the coast of Canada, tells us that even the most remote parts of the world are vulnerable to our human actions.
You mentioned earlier that there was a religious component for you.
There is, yes.
Any number of evangelical Christians are supporting the protection of the endangered species, groups like the NOAA Alliance, perhaps for the same reasons you gave.
Yes, I'm an Episcopalian. The Episcopal Church is like the Anglican Church from which I came. Obviously, I'm originally English. Has always had a strong position on the environment. Both the former Pope and the current Pope have the strong positions. A lot of major churches, understand that we are doing very significant things to our planet, and that poses a very serious ethical dilemma. I'm very heartened to see that attitude is now becoming more universally accepted across a lot of different Christian groups.
What's happening in Europe? Does the EU have any similar laws, or does the UK, your homeland, have any laws of this sort?
There's nothing quite like the Endangered Species Act, but there are individual laws and European-wide guidelines that in fact do require stewardship of the environment, that do protect species, that do protect the very places that they live. Europe is a much more heavily impacted continent than North America, and I think when people live in a place where there's a lot of people, they learn that the special places that remain, the Jamaica Bay of New York City, that those places are really vulnerable and special and wonderful, and we really have to go to a lot of trouble to protect them.
Interestingly, the Americas have become repositories of some European species brought over when Europeans came to the New World, and I suspect that there are some that thrive here that no longer even exist in Europe.
I actually don't think that's true in that particular case, but certainly there are indeed some species that have been moved from their original homes that are much commoner in their new homes than where they came from. It's not something I recommend. All those wonderful folks more than 100 years ago that wanted the birds of Shakespeare in Central Park and gave us the starling, don't we wish we could sort of go back and advise them not to do that?
You now live in North Carolina as a professor of Duke. Are there any endangered species in your neck of the woods?
There is. There's a woodpecker called the red-cockaded woodpecker that lives in pinelands across the South. And it's an example of how it's vital to get the the cooperation and goodwill of landowners. It likes pines that are big pines, 60, 100 years old. Of course, if you cut all your pines and grow Christmas trees, then you're not going to have the red-cockaded woodpecker. The people who have protected their land, or at least protected parts of it, have the red-cockaded woodpeckers. And there's a very encouraging and very successful collaboration between non-governmental organizations that care about the environment, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the landowners, to work out ways so that people can continue their economic activity and at the same time protect the woodpeckers. It's a good example of how, you know, how reasonable people can get together and come up with a solution.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the program.
Professor Stuart Pim of Duke University, a conservation biologist and professor of conservation ecology. And we are going to move on in just a few moments to look at the endangered species of the sea. Some people are saying the whole sea may go extinct by the year 2048. Stay with us. A recent report in the journal Science scared a lot of people when it warned that life in the seas could be effectively extinct by 2048. If that's true, it would be a disaster for both the fish in the seas and the people who make their living by fishing. Now, a group of over 30 scientists, economists, and fishery specialists have come together to make a plan for rebuilding fishing stocks and restoring fishing communities. Excuse me. With me now for the next part of Underreported is David Fester. Festa.
I'm sorry, David. That's quite all right.
Once you get a tickle, you're dead. I'm sure this is exciting radio. Gosh, tell us. Let's go to a break.